For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks this week, guys. It's good to have you all back and be live. We have some of our regulars on the show today, so that's good. Dave Birch, he's going to be joining us in a moment. But if you had the chance to read my post early in the week, I was talking about the dramatic shift that we're seeing in behavior of kids when it comes to signature. Because there's anecdotal evidence and some statistical evidence to show that about 1/4 or even in some places, even as high as 1/3 of kids coming out of university don't have a formal signature. And that's because they're starting to, well, first of all, they don't learn cursive writing at school, but they live in a world today where a signature is very rarely required. You don't need it to open a Google account. You don't need it to open an iTunes account or a Facebook account. What do you need a signature for these days? Well, you need it for banking. But that's a good question. Do we really – is a signature an effective way to identify someone anymore? The statistics would have us believe that it's actually not very effective at doing its job when it comes to identification. The United States has about 1/4 of the world's credit and debit card transactions, and when you look at all the traffic around the world, but they carry over 1/2 of the credit card fraud, and there's a firm correlation with the fact that the U.S. hasn't adopted the EMV standard and still does signature for most of the credit card and debit card approvals at the point of sale. When we move to chip and PIN, we get a dramatic reduction in fraud. So we see that chip and PIN is a superior mechanism for reducing fraud when it comes to a signature. So why do we still sign? Well, the argument is that your signature is your identity. But if these kids that are coming into the banking system over the next 10 years can't sign, does it mean we have to teach them to sign before they can operate efficiently in the banking system? How is identity going to change as the technology of banking changes around us? That's really what I wanted to talk about today and use that as a topic. And we're very delighted to invite back to the show Dave Birch. Welcome.
Thanks, Brett. Great to talk to you.
And Dave, this is a topic dear to your heart, this issue of identity, of course. We've talked about it before. But just recently, you've actually launched a new book on identity. Tell us about it.
Yeah, thanks very much for giving me the opportunity, Brett. The book is called Identity is the New Money. And it's about, it's about trying to get people to think about identity in a different way, trying to introduce people to, I think, more 21st century notions of identity and applying that to some practical situations. And I've chosen money as the example because it's easy and everybody understands it and they use it all the time. So the book tries to make, broadly speaking, two points. One is at the sort of, I guess you would almost call it the sort of trivial level. Identity is the new money in the sense that I very rarely use money. When I walk into a store to buy something with my card, I'm really using my identity to buy things. Very literally, in fact, because as we were joking the other day, when I was down in Las Vegas a couple of weeks ago, I went to buy a $3 cup of coffee at Starbucks using my erstwhile magnetic stripe card. And I was asked to produce photo ID. Which I thought was quite amusing. And because I'm English, so of course I didn't actually have any photo ID with me. But rummaging around in my bag, I found the expired building pass for a building in New York, which happens to have my photograph on it, although not my name. And I showed them that, and that was good enough, and that let me buy a cup of coffee. So the system is broken at every level,
yeah,
and it needs to be fixed, but you get the general point. You're buying things with your identity, not with money. But then I try to sort of look forward and project a more, I think, a slightly more subversive point, which is that if you look far down the road, if you see where the technology roadmap is going to, then identity will very literally replace money, because once you can manage identity, actually more particularly the reputations that attach to identities, in an effective and efficient way, suddenly you don't need intermediaries anymore. You don't need money as we know it. Now, I know that sounds slightly crazy, but I want to make the point that it's not a technological projection. So what I did, I talk to technologists all the time, so I have a pretty good picture in my head of the technological evolution of money, and most of the roadmaps that we build for our clients are about relatively short-term evolution. It's, you know, 1 to 2, 3 years. Obviously, customers don't want to invest things into dead ends, so they want to look at the longer-term roadmap, but really they're making shorter-term investments. But if you look a little bit further downstream, you need to go beyond technology to find out where this is going. And personally, I find social anthropologists to be the kind of people who have, you know, a very good kind of big picture handle on this. And I happen to be reading a very good book called The History of Money by a social anthropologist called Jack Weatherford. And a few years ago, not in that book, Jack said, and this has stuck with me, Jack said, the future of money is much more like money in the Neolithic past than it is to the money we have right now. And what he meant by that, I think, I'm interpreting, what he meant by that was, when we were a Neolithic clan, the work that we did for each other, the favors we did for each other, the goods we exchanged for each other, were maintained by collective memory. There was no intermediary. Everybody just remembered who owed who what, and who had mutual cross obligations with who. Now, obviously, that doesn't scale. So once you get below, once you get above a small, you can't remember who owes what to everybody. So then you start using tokens, like the giant stone disks on the island of Yap we were talking about before, or Babylonian
or pieces of animal skin with a
pieces of animal skin or seashells, as in North America. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. So you can't remember all of these things. So we need something. And hence you get this formulation of money as a form of memory, which I think is a really interesting insight.
It's interesting, actually, when you look at why money exists and you look historically at it, and you might have some ideas on this, but it's just it's an effort to try and create a standardized exchange of value so that everybody has the same value. Because in a barter system, the problem you get is if you have to exchange a chicken for a cow, then you know it's not a fair value exchange, right?
No, that's correct. Although you can see in the sort of small scale, it sort of works. So, you know, I give you a chicken and you give me some milk, and I give you chickens for a month and you give me a cow. I mean, we can all remember that kind of thing. It's only once it begins to scale above that that these things get lost, and you need these measures of value and other things. So you know, that all makes complete sense to me. And then you begin to think, well, hold on a second. If we had the memory, we wouldn't need those intermediaries. So we have those intermediaries because we can't remember those mutual cross obligations. But then you start to think, well, actually, we're kind of regaining this superpower memory because we're all connected to social networks. We're all it's an imperfect analogy because we don't have, as we'll discuss with Seb a bit later on, we don't yet have the strong enough identification and authentication technologies. But you can see conceptually that, you know, the social graph represents that collective memory. And it sounds crazy to talk that way, but you could imagine I do some work for you. You pay me using some crazy thing you've collected somewhere else. I don't know, tarmac or chickens or And then I don't want that, so I trade it away for something I want, like rides on the subway. And the subway people and it sounds crazy when you think about it in physical terms like that. But when you think about it in virtual terms, when you think about it on the 3 billion person global internet, if I've got some tarmac, there's going to be somebody else somewhere on the internet that wants it. And because I don't have to resolve that, that's, you know, these sort of barter chains, this kind of turbo barter, could be resolved in milliseconds by agents reaching out across the web. So basically, the idea of the book is to play with these two. You have the kind of short-term, simple thing we all understand. We're no longer using the physical money. We're using our identities. And we're using simple forms of reputation, like credit, to get what we want. But when you project that further downstream, it starts to point in a different and very interesting way. And I wanted to explore that and get people to think about identity in those different ways.
And it's interesting that when you see things like Bitcoin emerging, and you know, there's all sorts of arguments about Bitcoin and, you know, whether it's going to survive and all of those things. But the reality is, you see the world now trying to find new ways of exchanging value on top of the e-commerce layer or the IP layer in more efficient ways than we can do with geographically or physically based currencies.
That's true. And I can remember, I can't remember if it was on the show or not, but I can certainly remember talking to you about this 18 months, 2 years ago, and making the point that I felt, which I think actually holds up to examination, that using the Bitcoin technology, the blockchain, to manage these kind of asset transfers, to me seemed a very plausible and actually in many ways desirable downstream implementation. So the concepts of the Swift digital asset grid, but implemented in a distributed manner. To me, that actually sounds quite appealing. And I think that's, you know, that's not really related to Bitcoin as a currency. That's a different
issue. It's a bigger issue. Well, you know, on that point earlier about the issue of identity and the use of the signature and even in the use of an application form, as we move to digital, it's getting harder and harder to collect that information. And even with synthetic IDs and identity theft, you know, those old artifacts have no surety anymore. So how is it that do you think that the identity as a construct is going to evolve in this environment? And where's the gap for banks and financial service providers right now that rely on a face-to-face identity check?
Well, look, I think at the moment we divide the world into, well, in the payments world, we divide ourselves into two categories. We talk about card present and we talk about card not present. And that's a 50-year-old distinction, which is about to go away.
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense anymore.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. So we're going to move to a world where you have we'll call it a something present transaction. There's either something present that can authenticate you, or there isn't. Seb knows far more about this than me, so I'm going to leave it to Seb to talk about what's happening in the authentication world and FIDO and the standardization of those authentication transactions. But you can sort of see what I mean. I have something. It might be a phone, ring, hat, watch, badge, who knows. I have something that can authenticate me. And if that authentication is made, we can go ahead with the transaction. If it isn't made, we can't.
Because I've identified who you are, and therefore you're linked to a value store or a bank account somewhere where I can draw upon.
Well, you've identified a reputation that you want to transact with. Whether you've identified me, that's a different and more subtle issue. Because, for example, let's say my mobile operator is offering a mobile payment service, and they want to make customer privacy part of that proposition. So the operator gives me a phone. When I go into the store and use the phone gives up a token which says, I'm John Doe. You know, the authentication is made, the reputation is established, everything works. But whether the store knows it's Dave Birch or not, that's a different and separate issue. So we like to bundle those together, you know, when we're playing around with it with clients. We call this recognition. So does the store recognize you? Does the bank recognize you? And what that means is, does it have a combination of reputation and authentication, which is suitable for the appropriate transaction? buying a cup of coffee does not need photo ID.
No, absolutely.
And when I go in to buy a cup of coffee, let's say I'm doing it with my phone, right? So the phone knows it's me. It's in a place I normally am. It's buying the sort of thing I normally buy. You know, why would it bother me with passwords and pins and signatures or anything else? You know, the recognition is good enough. If I'm buying a car, you know, well, then we need to raise the bar slightly on the authentication and such like. But I think this idea of you know, getting the appropriate identification and authentication on a per transaction basis, which of course is vastly more flexible in the mobile. You know, with your card, you have what? You have the card and you have the signature, and that's it. That's the only combination you have available. The mobile phone has so many vectors open to it.
Yes.
So it's, you know, so I think, you know, this idea of the something present transaction is where we're going, and we can see a standardization both of the identity and of the authentication, which to me is a very positive development. And I think you'll find the retailers, I mean, you know, look, if I'm a retailer, I already, broadly speaking, I want PIN debit, because PINs have, I think, in one of the podcasts, much lower. I made a podcast in our iTunes series a couple of years ago with one of the guys from Walmart, and I think I'm remembering this right. I think he told me the PIN debit fraud rate was 1/250th of the signature debit.
Wow.
I mean, you know, it's a tiny, tiny. So they don't want signature. And in any case, what retailers look at the signature? Even if I did sign the card in my real name, which I never do, as you know.
Yeah.
Even if I did, what, you've got some anti-terrorist genius on the checkout who can evaluate these signatures.
And, you know, who's been trained in the art of handwriting.
Exactly. I mean, yes. It doesn't make it. You were right to call it out in that. That was a terrific blog piece, Brett, and you were right to call it out because it makes no sense.
Absolutely. You know, I really want to get into this topic of the smartphone as a vehicle or as that's tied with your identity. I love the quote that you gave me for the book, and in fact, it was on one of the last shows you're on. That, you know, 50 years time, when we look back on, you know, how the banking industry and payment space has changed, that we will identify the smartphone as the game changer. But as you say, that the ability of this to intersect data and information and bring it to bear to the problem of authentication or identification is so superior to the other artifacts we have in place today.
That's true. And it also offers a kind of flexibility, because one of the points of my book is about bringing this reputation management down to the transactional level. So when I go to make a transaction, I want to choose. Like, to me, it makes a difference. If I'm buying a cup of coffee, there's a difference between Dave Birch, the private citizen, buying a cup of coffee, and Dave Birch from Consult Hyperion buying a cup of coffee, because that's going to go on a business expense, and, you know, I need the receipt for it to give to my manager and so on. And, you know, John Doe buying a cup of coffee, because basically it's nobody's business, and that would be my default setting, would be John Doe or whatever. And Absolutely. The ability to choose those, you know, in the smartphone.
It should, well, the smartphone might be able to work it out itself.
It can work it out. It can make defaults depending on where I am or depending on learned behavior. So, like with my simple application, you know, which I like very much, you know, when I've paid in a restaurant a couple of times, it learns that this restaurant is where I go for business lunches, and it can default that for me. So the phone can do so much around that, which, you know, right now we don't really use. And the connections between you know, the financial services providers and the handset manufacturers and the operators and the app makers. At the moment, these things aren't, you know, as strong as they could be. Yeah. Although you have to say, you look at what guys like Simple are doing. You look at the results that came through yesterday from Braintree and Venmo and so on. You know, you can see things are building in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. We're getting the traction.
They're not where we should be, I don't think. I think we could work a little harder as an industry on that.
All right, well, Dave, let's go to a quick break, and then we'll ask Sebastian to join us and continue the conversation.
Terrific.
You're with Dave Birch and Brett King. We're talking Breaking Banks, and we'll be right back after this short break.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Your bank's customers expect comprehensive, convenient, and consistent service when and where they need it. A mobile app is a great start, but with so many devices and operating systems out there, it can be hard to keep up with demand. That's why today's leading banks count on the Kony Multichannel Experience Cloud. With Kony, you can design, develop, and manage multi-channel apps from one integrated platform. Build an app once, and with one click, you can deploy it securely across all digital channels, phones, tablets, desktop, and more. That means more efficiency for you and a better experience for your customers. Want to get to market fast? Explore Kony's range of ready-to-run apps, including retail, commercial, and private banking. With features like person-to-person transfers, targeted campaigns, built-in integrations, and cutting-edge compliance, Kony apps provide the framework and flexibility you need to rise above the competition. Go beyond first-generation mobile banking. Visit Kony.com/BK to launch your multi-channel strategy. That's Kony.com/BK.
Now you don't have to stay linked to your desktop or laptop. Take Voice America on the go and listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back after the break to Breaking Banks. I'm Brett King, your host, and I've got Dave Birch with me on the line from the UK. And at this point, I'd like to ask Sebastian Tavol to join us. Sebastian, tell us a bit about who you work for and your role there.
So, good afternoon, Brett. Thanks for having me on the show. So, I'm Sebastian Tavol. I'm the chief evangelist for a company called Synaptics, which is the manufacturer of fingerprint sensor that you can find on some of the Android-based devices. And I've been involved in the payment industry for quite some time. I was actually part of the mobile team at PayPal, building the early days platform that's being used today, and looking at the evolution of where payment was going and figuring out that identity was quite the next phase that we needed to solve beyond the mobile security.
Absolutely. Well, it's sort of tied up together, isn't it? If you can identify someone securely, then you solve the problem. You solve some of the problems of fraud and some of the issues of security, don't you?
Exactly. Actually, Dave was making a point, you know, that we are today relying on an infrastructure that's been the same for the past 50 years. And even if you go back further, and Dave loves his stories, you know, but the battering was mostly done with what you know and what you have. I know that I need that, and I have that good that I can trade with you. And modern authentication has been, you know, I have an email or I have a mobile phone number, and I know a password or I know a PIN. And that's been how we've been doing risk management until now. And in the worst case scenario, actually, I had a credit card and a signature. That's not working anymore. And when you add the mobile platform to the picture today, you can add new element. And you were talking about that earlier on the show. You know, like the device can give so much information. You can know actually, you can know where you are. And by where you are, I don't mean geolocation necessarily, but that could be like I am inside a device that is recognized and known by the service provider. And also you can add the who you are now with fingerprint sensor, microphone, and things like that. You know, you can add a lot of factors to do what I will call a strong authentication. And again, that leads straight to, we are surrounded by sensors today, that we like it or no. We have sensors all over us, in our pocket, on a mobile device, you know, on a computer, in our car. That can give a great combination actually to do active and passive authentication. You know, active authentication is when you ask the user to do really an action and to validate something. That's what Dave was mentioning. When you're going to buy a car, you may want to have some sort of control and have an active part inside the decision, right? But yeah. When you're going to buy a coffee at Starbucks in Las Vegas, you don't really want to be bugged, you know?
Right.
It's what, like $3 and that's about it, so.
So it could be that as these sensors get fast enough and the systems get efficient enough, the systems actually identified that you've walked into a Starbucks and I'm getting ready for you to buy. And as long as your phone is the one that presents the for the transaction, it's a reasonable verification of your identity. Whereas if it requires something that it's of a higher value transaction or something you haven't done before, it may require an additional level of authentication. So it's sort of a combination of knowing who you are, what you're doing, where you go. Broadly, we could call this heuristics, I guess, although it's not doesn't define it. You know, the behavior side of things as well, inbuilt into this. But there are times when, you know, something that is uniquely about you, such as your fingerprint or your voice print or your face, becomes a mechanism in securing a transaction or verifying your identity.
I think there are two aspects to that actually, Brett, because there's the identification and authentication itself, which to be honest, I would say for most of our clients, you know, they're looking at these in their roadmaps really just as cost reduction, because yeah. The cost of fraud and actually the cost of asserting identity is too high. So moving to standards-based, you know, FIDO authentication, smartphones, you know, it's largely about cost reduction. But I think you've just touched on something else there, which is there's the opportunity to build some new services on top of this. So you say, like, when I walk into the coffee shop, it recognizes my identity. Well, sort of. When I walk into the coffee shop, it recognizes an identity,
right,
which is under my choice, which is provided to me maybe by my bank or my MNO. And so identity, privacy, so they become part of the upfront product proposition rather than a kind of back office hygiene factors. So there's the cost reduction and simplification part of it. But I think there's also this idea that there's the potential for some new services out there.
Sorry, go ahead, Sebastian.
I was going to say, you know, that's a very good point that Dave is making, and the way I define it in my little simple mind is we are dealing with physical identities, which is I know Dave Birch, I know what he looks like physically. That's where the biometric, you know, can have an input, fingerprint, voice, facial recognition. And there is also the digital identities that we have. We all have multiple identities online, right? And we do different things with them. The convergence between the digital identities and the physical identities, what I call the social identity.
Yeah.
Or social identities. And that's what we should be able to trade with. And Dave makes a very important point here, which everyone wants to have some sort of privacy, even if we are oversharing today. But how do we manage or how do we rank the different identities that we want to share with which type of service we want to access? And I think that's where you have new business model and new ideas that can pop out is I could have like maybe 5-6 identities, and depending on what I'm doing, and the phone, the mobile device can help here, I will present one identity that I'm comfortable with.
Yeah, and I get it.
Yeah, I think in the book, this is one of the core ways I try to sort of distinguish thinking about new identity, or what Seb has just called social identity, from our sort of traditional notions of identity. I think a lot of people in their heads have an idea of identity as a kind of fixed thing, you know, an index card in a filing cabinet somewhere, which is you, where I think in this virtual world, you have different identities which serve different functions. And my identity as a family, at work, in my hobbies, arguing with people on bulletin boards, in the soccer fan club, you know, partitioning those identities is one of the fundamental defenses against, you know, fraud and privacy invasion and identity theft.
Yeah, because, you know, in certain environments, there's certain information that I may not want you to be privy to.
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, I mean, I don't want to get into a debate about what is privacy, but, you know, an element of it must be about control. And giving consumers control is a I think a core to getting them to trust these new services.
Now, Sebastian, on the biometrics front, you guys are obviously heavily involved in the fingerprinting technology at Synaptix. And I remember in the mid-90s, I had a software business that was deploying finger scan units back then, and the technology was okay. But in the last 20 years, this sort of biometric technologies like fingerprint recognition and so forth has become extremely accurate and extremely sensitive. In terms of the whole biometric field generally, what do you think that its role is going to be in the identity puzzle?
Well, I think that's going to be part of bringing the consumer presence. Dave was talking about card present, card not present. It's really you're dealing with the presence of the consumer or the user. That's when you can validate actually the person and actively requesting for something that will really put the person and the device in the same place. As you mentioned, the technology has evolved very, very rapidly, actually, especially over the past 3 or 4 years. And also the mentality around biometric technology has also evolved. And if you look at, Apple did a great job with Touch ID to what I will call democratize, and remove some of the fear that is attached to biometrics. And you have industry effort today like the FIDO Alliance, which was started by some service provider company.
What does FIDO stand for?
FIDO stands for Fast Identity Online.
Yep.
So okay, that was started actually, with companies like PayPal, Lenovo, Synaptix Validity was also one of the funding company. And the key element here is the idea of authentication is purely focused on the consumer and how the consumer can control the credentials associated to that identity. So instead of having a centralized database of biometric credentials like any government implementation or law enforcement that today, if you use Global Entry, that centralized database that goes and get back the information, that doesn't work in the consumer world because you can't be doing a one match versus millions of templates while the consumer is waiting at the cash register. The latency will be too much. Right. You don't want to wait 10 minutes, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So the technology was done on one-on-one match, and the way to do that is the template, the biometric template is stored on the consumer device, which is what Apple is doing, with Touch ID. That's also what Samsung is doing with the S5, is the template never leave the device. It's always under the control from of the consumer.
I think it's
that
also
is
worth,
a big change.
So I was going to say, Seb, I think it's also
go
worth
ahead,
making
Dave.
The point. On the 5S and on the Samsung S5, the biometric template is stored inside tamper-resistant hardware. It's not stored in the phone main memory. It's stored in a trusted execution environment.
Exactly. You isolate that critical element. And by the way, I'm going to simplify the way the FIDO Alliance works, but these credentials are never shared or they are not released to any service provider online. They are just the first step. When the first step of authentication of the user against the template, that's what we call the active authentication of the user, is done, there is a second step, which is that first step will release a key. That key is also shared and known by the service provider. Let's call it PayPal, for example. These two keys will open a session with which you can actually talk. The service provider can talk to the user can talk to the service provider. Now, if I'm the bad guy and I'm going after the centralized database of PayPal, now what I'm going to see, instead of seeing like emails and password, I'm going to see a bunch of keys. These keys, I have no clue how to link them back to the user or to the account.
Yeah.
So, and because
that happens in real time based on the hardware implementation.
Exactly, and because it's decentralized, it's really have to go on a one-on-one hack, which take a lot of time, and everyone is the same, and hackers, especially, they're a bit lazy. They will go for the easy path, right?
Yeah, absolutely, which is why social engineering is actually the way, identities are stolen these days more than actually, physically stealing information or hacking a system, I want to get away from the deep technology discussions a little bit here and say, How is this going to, and Dave, maybe this is best directed at you as a question, but Sebastian, feel free to jump in. But as, we obviously become more reliant on this new view of identity because it's more efficient and more secure and faster than, taking out your ID or signing a piece of paper. How is this going to change the way bank and payments companies are having to adapt? I mean, how many banks still require you to sign a signature card for opening a bank account?
Yeah, that's true. I think that is going to change. I think there are two problems that we need to deal with there. So one is, one is being addressed, which is using standards like FIDO, so that the bank doesn't need to know the technical details of how you were authenticated. It just knows you were authenticated to level 2 or level 3 or level 4 or whatever. So I say, for this transaction, the customer has to be authenticated to level 3. How you go about authenticating to level 3, I don't care. That's your thing. But there's a second issue, which is to do with federating between the different financial institutions. And I think there we've got some, you go to open a bank account, you go through all this KYC, AML, ATF, it costs loads of money, takes up loads of time. You go next door to get a mortgage or some insurance, you've got to go through the whole thing again because there's no way of federating the identity. So I think there's these two different things. We need to decouple the authentication. I think that's happening. But I think we also need to federate the identities. So once I've been through this process, once my phone app or whatever has been KYC, AML, ATF'd, I should be able to use that phone to go open another bank account. Right?
As long as it's been done in a trusted manner or according to a standard.
Right, because for opening the bank account, as per what Seb just said, you might say for opening a bank account, you need a fingerprint and a voice print whatever. But if it provided you can do that, then why not?
Absolutely. Sebastian, you got any thoughts?
Yeah, I was going to say actually that's going back a bit to the point that Dave made earlier in the segment, which was he was talking about the blockchain, on Bitcoin. Yeah. And that's the type of architecture that could work also for the Federation of Identity or the P2P Federation of Identity, where actually you will have maybe other person that may be in your social cluster that could
can
vouch
verify
for
your identity. Yeah.
Exactly. And then you have this system that goes and again, as Dave mentioned, you have different level of trust and identification, but you could find very simple mechanism with what is being done today. And to be fair, in the consumer world, that's good enough.
Well, in fact, we have recommendations on LinkedIn, which sure you can sort of game it a little bit, but generally, it is based on participation of the crowd. And then you have examples like Lendo has been on the show before, where they use you have to have an introduction from a Facebook friend to get access to microfunding or lending facilities. There are already starting to some examples of this vouching system are starting to emerge already.
Yeah, I think if you tie that in with more infrastructural view of identity and the stronger authentication, you can see the outlines of a new way of doing things. And again, it sounds crazy that you would give somebody a loan based on what their friends say, but actually it isn't. That's how things used to be done.
Yeah, well, because you used to take a loan off your friends.
That's right, exactly. So I don't think that – and, you talk about LinkedIn and Twitter. Yes, of course, there are ways of gaming these things. But actually, it's pretty difficult to make a convincing, long-term, reputational Facebook account. It's actually a lot of work. If you're going to pretend – to be somebody else on Facebook, that's really a lot of work. And Seb hit the nail on the head.
Well, it's a lot of work to do it properly.
You can see
fake Facebook profiles pretty quickly.
Yeah, and there are startups like Trulio and so on that will do this for you. But I think actually Seb's right. Criminals are lazy. They'll fake identity because that's easy. Faking reputation is difficult.
Yeah, good point. I like that. That's going to be one of the new quotes.
Yep.
All right, let's take a quick break, guys, and then we'll come back and talk about 5 to 10 years out, what things are going to look like. You're listening to Breaking Banks. We'll be right back after this quick break.
business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
Attend Payments 2014 to meet the forward-thinking leaders and disruptors who are transforming how we pay and get paid. Get a glimpse into the next wave of payments innovations and challenges through fast-paced interactive demonstrations, educational sessions, and a buzzing exhibit hall. Register now at payments.nacha.org. Payments 2014 is presented by NACHA, the Electronic Payments Association, the recognized leader in payment system education. The Payments Conference, transform imagination into strategic innovation. Register today at payments.nacha.org.
In sales, are you a lion or a vulture? Lions don't wait, they just go for it. Vultures hang around until the lions are finished and just pick up the scraps. How can you set yourself apart as a lion? Join the other aspiring sales lions and listen to Forget Patience, Let's Sell Something with host Ty Maynard. You'll learn the tips and strategies of top sales professionals. You'll gain more clients at a faster rate and at higher margins. If you're a sales professional, business owner, or executive, listen in every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel. From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back on Breaking Banks. So before the break, we were talking about how identity is changing, the nature of identity, the concept of a social identity or a digital identity, combining things that we know about you, identity markers, behaviors, and other measures of you as a person individually, but also combining your digital identities, your presence, and what we can find about you online that we can verify, including the potential of vouching, your friends vouching for you to say you really are who you say you are. So Dave and Sebastian, before you know, or as we continue on this discussion, my question really is, we can sort of see where this is going. I think the trends are clear, particularly the incorporation of biometrics technology is getting so good now. And Sebastian, as you pointed out, you know, with the Touch ID that Apple did, it's you know, the design of this is becoming almost built into the experience, where it's not clunky, it's beautiful, it's very easy to use. So biometric elements, facial recognition to unlock your phone. You know, I have the new Xbox One with Kinect, and that's how it recognizes me when I turn on my my Xbox One with the Kinect. You know, this stuff is just being built into the ecosystem now. It doesn't require you to go to any special effort. But how are we going to bridge the gap between the promise of this social identity or this combined identity and where we're at today? Which, you know, there's obviously the potential, but how do we get from where we are today to that future in 5 to 10 years' time? Dave, do you want to kick off?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think there are different approaches depending. I mean, there are different categories of organization that are, you know, jostling to play in this space. So you have the obvious example of banks, because they have to do the KYC AML anyway. So banks could do this. Mobile operators have a strong play in this space. They have the SIM. They know who you are. They know where you are. They know what you've been doing. You have what, you know, people lump up as the OTTs. So I log into a load of stuff with Google. Google, you know, has a pretty good idea of who I am and what I'm doing. But, you know, Apple, Facebook, people like that. Then you have, you know, there are pure plays coming up in that space who are only looking at managing the ID and so on. So there's different categories, and they have different business models around the ID and what they're going to do with the data, the distribution of that data. So I'm personally quite interested in the sort of VRM models where people have their personal
VRM?
VRM, the vendor relationship management, as opposed to CRM. So the idea there would be, you know, somebody, let's say the bank, looks after your personal data. they pump your personal data out in the equivalent of kind of an RSS feed. And if Target wants to know something about me, they subscribe to that feed. And when my personal data changes, it goes to Target. And when I don't want to deal with Target anymore, I can turn it off. So there are different people playing. And so how we get there, I think to some extent, depends on how these different players evolve the market. So I have suspicion.
How they're monetized, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I have a suspicion. Again, see, there are different banks at the moment tend to look at this as a way of reducing costs and saving money.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling there are other players in the market who see identity as a more strategic play. So you know, you have to suspect they'll you know, at this instant, they might have a little bit of an advantage.
Or those who have an identity platform. Facebook could be argued as an identity platform.
Yes, no, absolutely. And I think if you look at the difference between the very focused identity strategy around Facebook, whether it's desirable or not is another issue. And certainly, I'm sure there are classes of organization that don't want Facebook to mediate all of their relationships with their customers, but they're building a great identity platform and people like it. So people want to log in.
There's a good question that's just come in from Karachi in Pakistan from Faisal Khan. He said, well, how do you manage identities globally for something like payments, something that's accepted everywhere? And this sort of speaks to this because you can build these localized ecosystems, but how do we spread beyond that to something that's globally accepted?
Well, you've just given one global example, which is Facebook. But I think, if I wanted to sort of say something slightly more inflammatory. You can see a situation where because of the evolution of technologies, payments becomes commoditized, payments becomes a utility, anybody can do payments, it's easy. You can see a downstream environment where people like Visa and MasterCard switch identity and reputation and authentication instead of switching the payment, because anybody can switch the payment. But as Faisal has pointed out, you need some global interoperability around the identity and reputation. He's right, but I think it's entirely plausible to see that being done by some of the big players now.
And Sebastian, is there anything we're missing here? Is this purely a matter of putting enough commercial impetus behind this?
Well, I'm going to actually answer to both question or your question and the one coming from Pakistan is, at the end of the day, there is still a role for the government and the regulators. Dave was mentioning, there will be data being shared, data floating around. The consumer wants to make sure that there is still at least some privacy safeguards that are in place. That is important. That is important. Now going back also to how to share that identity globally, as I was mentioning, we all have physical identity that are mostly vouched by a government-issued ID card. So I have a passport, I have a driver's license, but these do not necessarily mean something sometime. Dave has a tendency to go and buy things in Las Vegas, signing Sergio Aguirre, a football player from Manchester City, I think, it has nothing to do with Dave, right? It's not even his real identity. And he always make a joke that if someone asks him for a piece of identification, he will give his Portuguese fishing license. Does that prove the physical identity of Dave Birch? Absolutely not. But if you bring in the picture the digital aspect of the identities associated with Dave.
And you show him on Facebook fishing in Portugal, that could be a big story.
Exactly. And I will be vouching that he is Sergio Aguirre because I know Dave. And I will say, yes, that's Sergio Aguirre that I know online. And that can be actually, or you bring the mechanism at the international level between, again, this digital and physical identity. And if one is a little bit less trusted than the other one, you can actually rely on another aspect or another fold to build that social identity that you want to deal with, where you are reaching a point, a level of confidence that, yes, you are dealing with the right person. And at the end of the day, it's all about trust.
Yeah, I think it's really a subject for another show, Brett, but I think there is a general problem around international KYC at the moment, which is having some unfortunate effects because the negative impacts of this sort of thing are largely felt by the less well off, the excluded. And the taller we build that barrier around KYC, AML, ATF, the more people we exclude. And that's not necessarily the right outcome. But I think that's a topic for another show.
Well, no, but that's, I mean, we have talked about the financial inclusion things previously. And when we had Costa from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, he was pointing out that, you know, a quarter of the African population can't satisfy identity requirements right now. So, you know, this is, but they probably also the ones that don't necessarily have a digital identity, but that would definitely change over the next 10 years as mobile phones become more ubiquitous. But, Dave, you talked a bit before about the telcos and the banks being good potential players in this because of the information they've connected. And it's interesting that in a place like Canada, and I think in Germany as well, that we've seen the government co-opt these guys into an identity schema to say, well, you guys have all the data. We just need to sort of put this into some forum where we can centralize this and we can recognize it as and tie it to some sort of government form of identity. Is that, you know, what role does the regulators play in creating these identity standards that, you know, that are interoperable?
Well, I think, to be honest, Seb is probably slightly better placed to answer that than me.
Do you have any?
Well, I think the government are sitting on a lot of data that are not necessarily under the control of the consumer or the user or the citizen. And that's when it's becoming a bit tricky on how you're sharing that. You know, like even here in the US, there is the big data effort at the government level, which is how to share this information that the government held on any citizen with commercial entities. So they are creating this system of buttons where you have the gold buttons that will be your financial tax information. The red buttons is your, your education. The blue button is your healthcare records. And the green button is your energy consumption, right? They have all this information. Do I have a say on how they are being stored and shared and everything? No, absolutely not. So that's where, again, there's also this privacy that's a twofold sword where the government has a role, but they also need to be more transparent on what they are doing with the data you're holding. And one of the points that Dave was making earlier, you know, like with Facebook identity, a lot of data are being shared. And today I'm guilty as charged. I'm oversharing on social media, right? However, I am never rewarded for that. So the company that will find a way in the future to reward me for oversharing or sharing my identities and being able to monetize that system both for finding value for the merchant or the retailers or the bank for its management, but also giving back some of this value for me, for myself, for my own benefit for sharing that, I think that will be where you will find a lot of the winning business model there.
Oh, yeah. It's a great way to sort of wrap it up. Listen, guys, we've only got a couple of minutes left in the show, so I'll get some closing comments from you. 5-10 years out, Dave, who's going to be the biggest players in identity?
Actually, I for all the criticism I made, I still think banks have a really central role to play. When you can put your money anywhere, when you can store money in your phone, in the Bitcoin, when you can store money anywhere, you need somewhere safe to store your identity. And that might well be what the bank does.
Yeah. And Sebastian, what are your thoughts? 5-10 years out.
I think the consumer actually will have the biggest say in what's happening. And they will be able to, I don't want to say dictate what is happening with their own data.
They'll be able to choose.
Yeah, but at least they will have a very strong say on what is being happening at their identity level.
Sure. Okay. And Dave, tell us where we can pick up your new book, Identity is the New Money.
It's available from all good bookstores, and I dare say some bad ones as well. But it's also on Amazon, Identity is the New Money.
Fantastic, and a great read. And that last paragraph you have in the book calling on the regulators and governments to participate in the solution, I thought was a great call to action. Sebastian, how do we find out more about what you and the Synaptics team are doing?
Well, I think you can look at the effort that the FIDO Alliance is doing and look at the announcement that we are making in the next months or so. We have a great membership. We went from 6 members to more than 100 members, and we have all the big names in the tech world worldwide. So I think you can look at what the FIDO Alliance is doing, and you will see where the industry is going as a collective effort.
What's the website for the FIDO Alliance?
I think that would be FIDOalliance.org.
Correct. Great. Fantastic. Well, gents, thank you very much for an enlightening show. Great to see that identity is evolving into something very interesting, and that it's something we all have. It's something we should all be interested in and care about, but the platform or mechanisms of how we identify you moving forward are definitely not going to be limited to a signature on the back of a piece of plastic. That's it for Breaking Banks this week. My thanks to Dave Birch and Sebastian Tavol for their participation, and we will be back with you next week.
Thanks,
see you later.
Brett.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Brett.
Thanks again.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.